This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction and nonfiction short stories. Today, Extraordinary Tales brings you an hour of short stories, originally aired on North Texas Radio of the Blind in Dallas. Enjoy.
Welcome back to an hour of short stories. I'm your host and narrator, John Pritchett. Our program today features three men, all near contemporaries. Our two Americans, Sherwood Anderson and Ernest Haycox, both influenced the writings of Ernest Hemingway. And our third author, William Somerset Maugham, was one of the most popular British authors of the 1900s. From Anderson, we have a comedy, from Haycox, a drama, and from Maugham, a parable. Influential American short story writer Sherwood Anderson was born in Ohio in 1876. His writing style can be detected in that of Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, John Steinbeck, and Thomas Wolfe. Beginning in 1924, Anderson lived near Jackson Square in New Orleans, where he entertained William Faulkner and Carl Sandburg. Married four times, Anderson died in Panama in 1941, and is buried in Virginia, where his epitaph reads, "Life, not death, is the great adventure." Here is "I Am a Fool" by Sherwood Anderson. It was a hard jolt for me, one of the most bitterest I ever had to face. And it all came about through my own foolishness, too. Even yet sometimes when I think of it, I want to cry or swear or kick myself. Perhaps even now, after all this time, there will be a kind of satisfaction in making myself look cheap by telling of it. It began at 3 o'clock one October afternoon, as I sat in the grandstand at the fall trotting and pacing meet at Sandusky, Ohio. To tell the truth, I felt a little foolish that I should be sitting in the grandstand at all, during the summer before I had left my hometown with Harry Whitehead and with a nigger named Bert, had taken a job as swipe with one of the two horses Harry was campaigning through the fall race meets that year. Mother cried, and my sister Mildred, who wanted to get a job as a school teacher in our town that fall, stormed and scolded about the house all during the week before I left. They both thought it something disgraceful that one of our family should take a place as a swipe with horse races. I have an idea Mildred thought my taking the place would stand in the way of her getting the job she'd been working so long for. But after all, I had to work, and there was no other work to be got. A big lumbering fellow of 19 couldn't just hang around the house, and I had got too big to mow people's lawns and sell newspapers. Little chaps who could get next to people's sympathies by their sizes were always getting jobs away from me. There was one fellow who kept saying to everyone who wanted a lawn mowed or a cistern clean that he was saving money to work his way through college, and I used to lay awake nights thinking up ways to injure him without being found out. I kept thinking of wagon running over him and bricks falling on his head as he walked along the street. But never mind him. I got the place with Harry, and I liked Bert fine. We got along splendid together. He was a big nigger with a lazy, sprawling body and soft, kind eyes, and when it came to a fight, he could hit like Jack Johnson. He had a Bucephalus, a big, black pacing stallion that could do 209 or 210 if he had to, and I had a little gelding named Dr. Fritz that never lost a race all fall when Harry wanted him to win. We set out from home late in July in a boxcar with the two horses, and after that, until late November, we kept moving along the race meets and the fairs. It was a peachy time for me, I'll say that. Sometimes I think that boys who are raised regularly in houses and never have a fine nigger like Bert for a best friend and go to high schools and colleges and never steal anything or get drunk a little or learn to swear from fellas who know how or come walking up in front of a grandstand in their shirt sleeves with dirty horsey pants on when the races are going on and the grandstand is full of people all dressed up. What's the use of talking about it? Such fellas don't know nothing at all. They've never had no opportunity. But I did. Bert taught me how to rub down a horse and put bandages on after a race and steam a horse out and a lot of valuable things for any man to know. He could wrap a bandage on a horse's leg so smooth that if it had been the same color, you would think it was his skin. And I guess he'd been a big driver, too, and got to the top like Murphy and Walter Cox and the others if he hadn't been black. Gee whiz, it was fun. You got to a county seat town, maybe say on Saturday or Sunday, and the fair began the next Tuesday and lasted until Friday afternoon. Dr. Fritz would be, say, in the 225 trot on Tuesday afternoon, and on Thursday afternoon, Bucephalus would knock 'em cold in a free-for-all pace. It left you a lot of time to hang around and listen to horse talk and see Bert knock some yap cold that got too gay, and you'd find out about horses and men and pick up a lot of stuff you could use all the rest of your life if you had some sense and salted down what you heard and felt and saw. And then at the end of the week, when the race meet was over and Harry had run home to tend up to his livery stable business, you and Bert hitched the horses to carts and drove slow and steady across the country to the place for the next meeting, so as not to overheat the horses, etc., etc., you know. Gee whiz, gosh almighty, the nice hickory nut and beech nut and oaks and other kinds of trees along the roads, all brown and red, and the good smells, and Bert singing a song that was called Deep River, and the country girls at the windows of houses and everything. You can stick your colleges up your nose for all me. I guess I know where I got my education. Why, one of those little burgs of towns you come to on the way, say now on a Saturday afternoon, and Bert says, let's lay up here. And you did. And you took the horses to a livery stable and fed them, and you got your good clothes out of a box and put them on. And the town was full of farmers gaping because they could see you were racehorse people, and the kids maybe never seen a nigger before and was afraid and run away when the two of us walked down the main street. And that was before Prohibition and all that foolishness. And so you went into a saloon, the two of you, and all the yaps come and stood around, and there was always someone pretended he was horsey and knew all things and spoke up and began asking questions. And all you did was to lie and lie all you could about what horses you had, and I said I owned them. And then some fella said, will you have a drink of whiskey? And Bert knocked his eye out of the way he could say offhand like, oh, well, all right, I'm agreeable to a little nip. I'll split a quart with you. Gee whiz. But that isn't what I want to tell my story about. We got home late in November, and I promised Mother I'd quit the horse races for good. There's a lot of things you've got to promise a mother because she don't know any better. And so, there not being any work in our town any more than when I left there to go to the races, I went off to Sandusky and got a pretty good place taking care of horses for a man who owned a teaming and delivery and storage and coal and real estate business there. It was a pretty good place with good eats and a day off each week, and sleeping on a cot in the big barn, and a lot of just shoveling in hay and oats to a lot of big good enough skates of horses that couldn't have trotted a race with a toad. I wasn't dissatisfied, and I could send some money home. And then, as I started to tell you, the fall races come to Sandusky, and I got the day off and I went. I left the job at noon and had on my good clothes and my new brown derby hat I'd just bought the Saturday before and a stand-up collar. First of all, I went downtown and walked about with the dudes. I've always thought to myself, put up a good front, and so I did it. I had $40 in my pocket, and so I went into the West House, a big hotel, and walked up to the cigar stand. Give me 3 25-cent cigars, I said. There was a lot of horsemen and strangers and dressed-up people from other towns standing around in the lobby and in the bar, and I mingled amongst them. In the bar there was a fellow with a cane and a Windsor tie on, that it made me sick to look at him. I like a man to be a man and dress up, but not to go put on that kind of airs. So I pushed him aside kind of rough and had me a drink of whiskey, and then he looked at me as though he thought maybe he'd get gay, but he changed his mind and didn't say anything. And then I had another drink of whiskey, just to show him something, and went out and had a hack out to the races, all to myself, and when I got there, I bought myself the best seat I could get up in the grandstand, but didn't go in for any of those boxes. That's putting on too many airs. And so there I was, sitting up in the grandstand as gay as you please, and looking down on the swaps coming out with their horses, with the dirty horsey pants on and the horse blanket swung over their shoulders, same as I had been doing all the year before. I liked one thing about the same as the other, sitting up there and feeling grand, and then down there and looking up at the yaps and feeling grander and more important, too. One thing's about as good as another if you take it just right. I've often said that. Well, right in front of me in the grandstand that day, there was a fellow with a couple of girls, and they was about my age. The young fellow was a nice guy, all right. He was the kind maybe that goes to college and then comes to be a lawyer or maybe a newspaper editor or something like that. There are some of that kind that are all right, and he was one of the ones. He had his sister with him and another girl, and the sister looked around over his shoulder, accidental at first, not intending to start anything. She wasn't that kind, and her eyes and mine happened to meet. You know how it is. She had on a soft dress, kind of a blue stuff, and it looked carelessly made, but was well sewed and made and everything. I knew that much. I blushed when she looked right at me, and so did she. She was the nicest girl I've ever seen in my life. She wasn't stuck on herself, and she could talk proper grammar without being like a school teacher or something like that. What I mean is, she was okay. I think maybe her father was well-to-do but not rich to make her chesty because she was his daughter, as some are. Maybe he owned a drugstore or a dry goods store in their hometown, or something like that. She never told me, and I never asked. My own people are okay, too, when you come to that. My grandfather was Welsh, and over in the old country, in Wales he was. But never mind that. The first heat of the first race come off, and the young fella sitting there with the two girls left them and went down to make a bet. I knew what he was up to, but he didn't talk big and noisy and let everyone around know he was a sport as some do. He wasn't that kind. Well, he come back, and I heard him tell the two girls what horse he'd bet on. And when the heat was trotted, they all half got to their feet and acted in the excited, sweaty way people do when they've got money down on a race, and the horse they bet on is up there pretty close to the end, and they think maybe he'll come on with the rush, but he never does because he hasn't got the old juice in him, come right down to it. And then pretty soon the horses come out for the 218 pace, and there was a horse in it I knew. He was the horse Bob French had in his string, but Bob didn't own him. He was a horse owned by Mr. Mathers down at Marietta, Ohio. This Mr. Mathers had a lot of money and owned some coal mines or something, and he had a swell place out in the country, and he was stuck on racehorses, but as a Presbyterian or something, and I think more than likely his wife was one too, maybe a stiffer one than himself. So he never raced his horses himself, and the story around Ohio racetracks was that when one of the horses got ready to go to the races, he turned him over to Bob French and pretended to his wife he was sold. So Bob had the horses, and he did pretty much as he pleased, and you can't blame Bob. At least I never did. Sometimes he was out to win, and sometimes he wasn't. I never cared much about that when I was swiping a horse. What I did want to know was that my horse had the speed and could go out in front if you wanted him to. And, as I was telling you, there was Bob in this race with one of Mr. Mathers' horses, was named About Ben Aham, or something like that, and was fast as a streak. He was a gelding at a mark of 221, but could step in 08 or 09. Because when Bert and I were out, as I've told you, the year before, there was a nigger Bert knew worked for Mr. Mathers, and we went out there one day when he didn't have no race on at the Marietta Fair, and our boss Harry was gone home. And so everyone was gone to the fair but just this one nigger, and he took us all through Mr. Mathers' swell house, and he and Bert tapped a bottle of wine Mr. Mathers had hid in his bedroom back in his closet without his wife knowing, and he showed us his Ahem horse. Bert was always stuck on being a driver but didn't have much chance to get on top, being a nigger, and he and the other nigger gulped that whole bottle of wine, and Bert got a little lit up. So the nigger let Bert take this About Ben Aham and step him a mile in a track Mr. Mathers had all to himself, right there on the farm. And Mr. Mathers had one child, a daughter, kind of sick and not very good looking, and she came home and we had to hustle to get About Ben Aham stuck back in the barn. I'm only telling you to get everything straight. At Sandusky that afternoon, I was at the fair. This young fellow with the two girls was fussed, being with the girls and losing his bet. You know how a fella is that way? One of them was his girl and the other his sister. I had figured that out. Gee whiz, I says to myself, I'm going to give him the dope. He was mighty nice when I touched him on his shoulder. He and the girls were nice to me right from the start and clear to the end. I'm not blaming them. And so he leaned back and I give him the dope on about Ben Ahem. Don't bet a cent on his first heat because he'll go like an oxen hitched to a plow. But when the first heat is over, go right down and lay on your pile. That's what I told him. Well, I never saw a fella treat anyone sweller. There was a fat man sitting beside the little girl that had looked at me twice by this time, and I at her, and both blushing, and what did he do but have the nerve to turn and ask the fat man to get up and change places with me so I could set with his crowd. Gee whiz, craps a'mighty, there I was. What a chump I was to go and get gay up there in the White House bar, and just because that dude was standing there with a cane and that kind of necktie on. To go and get all balled up and drink that whiskey just to show off. Of course she would know, me sitting right beside her and letting her smell of my breath. I could have kicked myself right down out of that grandstand and all around that racetrack and made a faster record than most of the skates of horses they had there that year. Because that girl wasn't any mutt of a girl, what wouldn't I have give right then for a stick of chewing gum to chew or a lozenger or some licorice or most anything? I was glad I had those 25-cent cigars in my pocket, and right away I give that fellow one and lit one myself. Then that fat man got up and we changed places, and there I was, plucked right down beside her. They introduced themselves, and the fellow's best girl he had with him was named Miss Eleanor Woodbury, and her father was a manufacturer of barrels from a place called Tiffin, Ohio. And the fellow himself was named Wilbur Wesson, and his sister was Miss Lucy Wesson. I suppose it was their having such swell names got me off my trolley. A fella, just because he's been a swipe for a racehorse and works taking care of horses for a man in the team and delivery and storage business, isn't any better or worse than anyone else. I've often thought that, too, and said it, too. But you know how a fella is. There's something in that kind of nice clothes, in the kind of nice eyes she had, and the way she had looked at me a while before over her brother's shoulder, and me looking back at her and both of us blushing. I couldn't show her up for a boob, could I? I made a fool of myself. That's what I did. I said my name was Walter Mathers from Marietta, Ohio, and then I told all three of them the smashingest lie you ever heard. What I said was that my father owned the horse about Ben Ahem, and that he had let him out to this Bob French for racing purposes, because our family was proud and had never gone into racing that way, in our own name, I mean. Then I got started, and Miss Lucy Wesson's eyes were shining, and I went the whole hog. I told about our place down at Marietta, and about the big stables and the grand brick house we had on a hill up above the Ohio River. But I knew enough not to do it in no bragging way. What I did was to start things and let them drag the rest out of me. I acted just as reluctant to tell as I could. Our family hasn't got any barrel factory, and since I've known this, we've always been pretty poor, but not asking anything of anyone at that. And my grandfather over in Wales, but never mind that. We sat there talking like we had known each other for years and years, and I went and told them that my father had been expecting maybe this Bob French wasn't on the square and had sent me up to Sandusky on the sly to find out what I could. And I bluffed it through. I had found out all about the 218 pace in which about Ben Ahem was about to start. I said he would lose the first heat by pacing like a lame cow and then would come back and skin him alive after that. And to back up what I said, I took $30 out of my pocket and handed it to Mr. Wilbur Wesson and asked him, would he mind, after the first heat, to go down and place it on about Ben Ahem for whatever odds he could get. What I said was that I didn't want Bob French to see me and none of the swipes. Sure enough, when the first heat come off and about Ben Ahem went off his stride, up the backstretch, and looked like a wooden horse or a sick one, and come in to be last. Then this Wilbur Wesson went down to the betting place under the grandstand, and there I was with the two girls. And when that Miss Woodbury was looking the other way once, Lucy Wesson kinda, with their shoulder, you know, kinda touched me. Not just tucking down, I don't mean. You know how a woman can do? They get close, but not getting gay either. You know what they do? Gee whiz. And then they gave me a jolt. What they had done, when I don't know, was to get together, and they had decided Wilbur Wesson would bet $50, and the two girls had gone and put in $10 each of their own money, too. I was sick then, but I was sicker later. About the gelding, about Ben A.M. and their winning their money, I wasn't worried a lot about that. It come out okay. A.M. stopped the next three heats like a bushel spoiled eggs going to market before they could be found out, and Wilbur Wesson had got 9-2 for the money. There was something else eating at me. Because Wilbur come back, and after he bet the money, and after that he spent most of his time talking to that Miss Woodbury, and Lucy Wesson and I were left alone together like on a desert island. Gee, if I'd only been on the square, or if there'd been any way of getting myself on the square. There ain't any Walter Mathers, like I said to her and them, and there hasn't ever been one. But if there was, I'd bet I'd go to Marietta, Ohio, and shoot him tomorrow. There I was, big boob that I am. Pretty soon the race was over, and Wilbur had gone down and collected our money, and we had a hack downtown, and he stood us to a swell supper at the West House, and a bottle of champagne besides. And I was with that girl, and she wasn't saying much, and I wasn't saying much either. One thing I know, she wasn't stuck on me because of the lie about my father being rich and all. There's a way you can know. Craps almighty! There's a kind of girl you see once in your life, and if you don't get busy and make hay, then you're gone for good and all, and might as well go jump off a bridge. They give you a look from inside of them somewhere, and it ain't no vampin'. And what it means is, you want that girl to be your wife, and you want nice things around her like flowers and swell clothes, and you want her to have the kids you're going to have, and you want good music played and no ragtime. Gee whiz! There's a place over near Sandusky across a kind of bay, and it's called Cedar Point. And after we had supper, we went over to it in a launch, all by ourselves. Wilbur and Miss Lucy and that Miss Woodbury each had to catch a 10 o'clock train back to Tiffin, Ohio, because when you're out with girls like that, you can't get careless and miss any trains and stay out all night like you can with some kinds of Janes. And Wilbur blowed himself to the launch, and it cost him 15 cold plunks. But I would never have knew it if I hadn't listened. He wasn't no tin horn kind of a sport. Over at the Cedar Point place, we didn't stay around where there was a gang of common kind of cattle at all. There was big dance halls and dining places for yaps, and there was a beach you could walk along and get where it was dark, and we went there. She didn't talk hardly at all, and neither did I, and I was thinking how glad I was my mother was all right, and always made us kids learn to eat with a fork at the table and not swill soup, and not be noisy and rough like a gang you see around a racetrack that way. Then Lucy and his girl went up the beach, and Lucy and I sat down in a dark place where there was some roots of old trees the water had washed up, and after that the time till we had to go back in the launch and they had to catch their trains wasn't nothing at all. It went like winking your eye. Here's how it was. The place we were setting in was dark, like I said, and there was the roots from that old stump sticking up like arms, and there was a watery smell, and the night was like, as if you could put your hand out and feel it, so warm and soft and dark and sweet like an orange. I most cried, and most swore, and most jumped up and danced. I was so mad and happy and sad. When Wilbur come back from being alone with his girl, and she saw him coming, Lucy says, we got to go to the train now. And she was almost crying too, but she never knew nothing I knew, and she couldn't be so all busted up. And then, before Wilbur and Miss Woodbury got up to where we was, she put her face up and kissed me quick, and put her head up against me, and she was all quivering and... gee whiz! Sometimes I hope I have cancer and die. I guess you know what I mean. We went in the launch across the bay to the train like that, and it was dark, too. She whispered and said it was like she and I could get out of the boat and walk on the water, and it sounded foolish, but I knew what she meant. And then quick we were right at the depot, and there was a big gang of yaps, the kind that go to the fairs and crowded and milling around like cattle, and how could I tell her? It won't be long because you'll write, and I'll write to you. That's all she said. I got a chance like a hay barn afire. A swell chance I got. And maybe she would write me down at Marietta that way, and the letter would come back and stamped on the front of it by the USA, "There ain't any such guy," or something like that, whatever they stamp on a letter that way. And me trying to pass myself off as a big buck and a swell, to her, as decent a little body as God ever made. Craps almighty, a swell chance I got. And then the train came in, and she got on it, and Wilbur Wesson, he come and shook hands with me, and that Miss Woodbury was nice, too, and bowed to me, and I at her, and the train went, and I busted out and cried like a kid. Gee, I could have run after that train and made Dan Patch look like a freight train after a wreck, but socks a'mighty, what was the use? Did you ever see such a fool? I'll bet you what, if I had an arm broke right now or a train had run over my foot, I wouldn't go to no doctor at all. I'd go set down and let her hurt and hurt. That's what I'd do. I'll bet you what, if I hadn't drunk that booze, I'd have never been such a boob as to go tell such a lie that couldn't never be made straight to a lady like her. I wish I had that fella right here that had on a Windsor tie and carried a cane. I'd smash him for fair. Gosh darn his eyes, he's a big fool, that's what he is. And if I'm not another, you just go and find me one, and I'll quit working and be a bum and give him my job. I don't care nothing for working and earning money and saving it for no such boob as myself.
Western fiction writer Ernest Haycox was born in Portland, Oregon in 1819 and received a journalism degree from the University of Oregon. The author of more than 300 short stories and a couple dozen novels, he began his literary career contributing to pulp magazines in the 1920s. His stories later appeared in the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's Weekly. 9 of his novels were made into movies, including Stagecoach, that made John Wayne a star, Union Pacific, that featured Barbara Stanwyck and Joel McRae, and The Far Country, that starred James Stewart. The Western Writers of America voted Haycox, who died in 1950, one of the 24 best Western writers of the 20th century. Here is A Question of Blood by Ernest Haycox.
That fall of 1869, when Frank Isabel settled in the Yellow Hills, the nearest town was a 4-day ride to the north, and his closest white neighbor lived at the newly established Hat Ranch, 70 miles over in Two Dance Valley. The Indians were on reservation, but it was still risky for a man to be alone in the country. It made no difference to Isabel. He was young and self-willed, and raised in that impoverished and faction-torn part of Missouri where manhood came to a male child almost as soon as he could lift a gun. He had a backwoodman's lank, loose height. His eyes were almost black, and though he kept a smooth-shaven face, there was always a clay blue cast to the long sides of his jaw. The land was free, well grassed and watered, and ideal for a poor man who had ambition. This is why he had come. Yet self-sufficient as he was, he had made no calculation for the imperious hungers that soon or late come to a lonely man. And presently, seeing no hope of a white woman in the land for many years, he went down to the reservation and took unto himself a Crow girl, the bargain being sealed by payment to her father of one horse and a quart of whiskey. She was quick and small and neat, with enormous eyes looking out of a round, smooth face. The price paid was small, and that hurt her pride for a little while, yet it was a white man who wanted her, and the hurt died down, and she moved quietly into Frank Isabel's log house and settled down to the long, lonesome days without murmur. She was more than he had expected in an Indian woman, quick to perceive the way his mind ran,
showing him sudden streaks of mischief-making gaiety and sometimes a flash of affection. Before the baby boy was born, he drove her 300 miles to Cheyenne and married her in the white way. It was a sense of justice that impelled him to do this, rather than any need in her eyes, for he was learning that the horse and bottle of whiskey were as binding as any ceremony on earth. And he was also learning that though an Indian woman was a dutiful woman, immemorial custom guided her in a way that he could not hope to touch or change. A man's work was a man's. A woman's work was hers, and the line was hard and clear. In the beginning, he had shocked her by cutting the firewood and dressing down the game he brought in. It had shamed her for a while that he should descend to those things, and only by angry command had he established the habit of eating at table instead of cross-legged on a floor blanket. She was faithful to the discharge of the duty she owed him, but behind that girlish face was an adamant will. The ways of 1,000 generations were ingrained in her. Often at night, smoking before the fire and watching his boy crawl so awkwardly across the floor, he felt a strangeness at seeing her darkly crouched in a corner, lost in thoughts he could never reach. Sometimes the color and the sound of his early days in Missouri came strongly to him, and he wished that she might know what was in his head. But he talked her tongue poorly, and she would speak no English. And so silence lay between them. Meanwhile, Two Dance Town was born on the empty prairie 60 miles away, and the valley below him began to fill up with cattlemen long before he had thought they would come. Looking down from the ramparts of the Yellows, he could see houses far off under the sun, and dust spiral up along the Two Dance Road, signals of a vanishing wilderness. His own people had finally caught up with him, and then he knew he had become a squaw man. One by one, the few trappers who had pioneered the Yellows began to send their squaws and their half-breed children back to the reservation as a shame-faced gesture of a mistake that had to be righted. He had said nothing of this to the Crow woman, yet when fear showed its luminous shadow in her eyes, he knew she had heard. He said then, "Those men are fools. I am not ashamed of you," and was happy to see the fear die. This was why he took her to Two Dance. It pleased him to have her be seen in that lively little cattle town, for she was a pretty woman, with her black hair braided, and her clothes neat and colorful under the sun. But he had forgotten her customs, and when they walked up the street, she followed behind him, as a squaw always did, obediently and with her head faintly lowered. He knew how Two Dance would see that, and anger colored his talk to her on the way home. A white man's wife walks beside him, not behind. He saw that dark fear in her eyes again, and had no way of softening it. Never afterwards did she come to town. He knew then how it was to be. At haytime, when he went down to help out on Hat, he could feel that faint line drawn between him and the others. At the roundup fire he sat apart, with the strangeness there, a white man who was yet not quite white. One fall night at town he stepped in to watch the weekly dance, and felt all the loose bitterness of his position rise and grow to be a hard lump in his chest. Once he would have been a part of this, but the odor of the blanket was upon him now, and those fair, pleasant girls went wheeling by, and he saw their eyes touch him and pass on. Over the whiskey bottle in Pharaoh Charlie's saloon later he understood how fatal his mistake had been, and how everlastingly long its penalty would be. He went home late that night quite drunk. In the morning the Crow girl was gone with her boy. He didn't follow, for he knew that either she would return or she wouldn't, and that nothing he did could change her mind. Late in the third day she came back without a word. When he went in to supper that night, he sat down to a single plate on the table. Her own plate and the boy's were on a floor blanket in a corner of the room. It was, he saw, her decision. He had told her nothing of the misery in his mind, but she knew it without need of speech, and so had answered him. He was white and might eat at his table. But she was Indian, and so was the boy, and the table was not for them. There was kindness in Frank Isabel that governed the strongest of his emotions, and this was what held him still as the days went on. He was remembering back to the horse and bottle of whiskey, and to the time when her lips had been warm with humor. In those days the Yellows had been wild, and his world had not caught up with them. But he could see the depth and the length of his mistake now. He had committed it and could stand it. Yet it had passed beyond him and touched the Crow girl and the boy who was neither Crow nor white. For himself, Frank Isbell thought there was no help. For the girl, none. It was the boy he kept weighing in his mind, so slowly and so painfully. One winter night at mealtime, Jim Bimbo of Hat dropped in for a cup of coffee. There was a little talk of cattle snowed into the timber, and afterwards Bimbo put on his hat and went to the door. As he left, his glance crossed to the Crow woman and to the boy crouched in the corner, and he said briefly, "Your youngster's growing up, Frank," and he left. There was the rush of wind along the cabin eaves and deep silence inside. Isabel sat with his arms idle on the table, remembering Benbow's words, which had contained a note of judgment. Presently he rose and brought another chair to the table and went over to where the Crow girl crouched mutely in the corner. He lifted the boy and put him in the chair at the table and stood there a moment, a long man throwing a thin shadow across the room. He said, "Hereafter he eats at the table." She drew farther and farther back into the corner, like a shadow vanishing, and then, with his face turned suddenly away, he heard her stifled and terrible crying tremble the room's silence. William Somerset Maugham was born in Paris in 1874, the son of a British embassy official, and served in the British Secret Service during World War I. He is considered one of the most popular British authors of the 1900s. He established himself as a serious writer with his semi-autobiographical work of Human Bondage, and was also an author of many sophisticated plays and collections of short stories. I have in my library the Maugham Reader, containing 20 of his most popular short stories. Unfortunately, nearly all are too long to include in this program, which is devoted to the shorter variety. Here, however, is the 20-minute classic, September's Bird. First, the King of Siam had two daughters, and he called them Night and Day. Then he had two more, so he changed the names of the first ones and called the four of them after the seasons, Spring and Autumn, Winter and Summer. But in the course of time he had three others, and he changed their names again and called all seven by the days of the week. But when his eighth daughter was born, he did not know what to do till he suddenly thought of the months of the year. The queen said that there were only 12, and it confused her to have to remember so many new names. But the king had a methodical mind, and when he made it up, he would never change it if he tried. He changed the names of all his daughters and called them January, February, March, though of course in Siamese, till he came to the youngest, who was called August, and the next one was called September. "That only leaves October, November, and December," said the queen. "And after that we shall have to begin all over again." "No, we shan't," said the king, "because I think 12 daughters are enough for any man, and after the birth of dear little December, I shall be reluctantly compelled to cut off your head." He cried bitterly when he said this, for he was extremely fond of the queen. Of course it made the queen very uneasy, because she knew it would distress the king very much if he had to cut off her head, and it would not be very nice for her. But as it happened, there was no need for either of them to worry, because September was the last daughter they ever had. The queen only had sons after that, and they were called after the letters of the alphabet, so there was no cause for anxiety there for a long time, since she had only reached the letter J. Now the King of Siam's daughters had had their characters permanently embittered by having to change their names in this way, and the older ones, whose names of course had been changed oftener than the others, had their characters more permanently embittered. But September, who had never known what it was to be called anything but September, except, of course, by her sisters, who, because their characters were embittered, called her all sorts of names, had a very sweet and charming nature. The King of Siam had a habit which I think might be usefully imitated in Europe. Instead of receiving presents on his birthday, he gave them, and it looks as though he liked it, for he used often to say he was sorry he had only been born on one day, and so only had one birthday in that year. But in this way he managed, in course of time, to give away all his wedding presents and the loyal addresses which the mayors of the cities in Siam presented him with, and all his old crowns which had gone out of fashion. One year on his birthday, not having anything else handy, he gave each of his daughters a beautiful green parrot in a beautiful golden cage, and on each cage was written the name of the month, which was the name of the princess it belonged to. The nine princesses were very proud of their parents, and they spent an hour every day, for like their father, they were of a methodical turn of mind, in teaching them to talk. Presently, all the parrots could say, "God save the king," in Siamese, which is very difficult. And some of them could say "Pretty Polly" in no less than seven Oriental languages. But one day, when Princess September went to say good morning to her parrot, she found it lying dead at the bottom of its golden cage. She burst into a flood of tears, and nothing that her maids of honor could say comforted her. She cried so much that the maids of honor, not knowing what to do, told the queen, and the queen said it was stuff and nonsense, and the child had better go to bed without any supper. The maids of honor wanted to go to a party, so they put Princess September to bed as quickly as they could and left her by herself. And while she lay in her bed, crying still, even though she felt rather hungry, she saw a little bird hop into her room. She took her thumb out of her mouth and sat up. Then the bird began to sing, and he sang a beautiful song all about the lake in the king's garden, and the willow trees that looked at themselves in the still water, and the goldfish that glided in and out of the branches that were reflected in it. When he had finished, the princess was not crying anymore, and she quite forgot that she had had no supper. "That was a very nice song," she said. The little bird gave her a bow, for artists have naturally good manners, and they like to be appreciated. "Would you care to have me instead of your parrot?" said the little bird. "It's true that I'm not so pretty to look at, but on the other hand, I have a much better voice." The Princess September clapped her hands with delight, and then the little bird hopped onto the end of her bed and sang her to sleep. When she woke next day, the little bird was still sitting there. And as she opened her eyes, he said, "Good morning." The maids of honor brought in her breakfast, and he ate rice out of her hand, and he had his bath in her saucer. He drank out of it, too. The maids of honor said they didn't think it was very polite to drink one's bath water, but the Princess September said that was the artistic temperament. When he had finished his breakfast, he began to sing again, so beautifully that the maids of honor were quite surprised, for they had never heard anything like it, and the Princess September was very proud and happy. "Now I want to show you to my eight sisters," said the princess. She stretched out the first finger of her right hand so that it served as a perch, and the little bird flew down and sat on it. Then, followed by her maids of honor, she went through the palace and called on each of the princesses in turn, starting with January, for she was mindful of etiquette, and going all the way down to August. And for each of the princesses, the little bird sang a different song, but the parrots could only say, "God save the king," and "Pretty Polly." At last she showed the little bird to the king and queen. They were surprised and delighted. "I knew I was right to send you to bed without any supper," said the queen.
"The bird sings much better than parrots," said the king.
"I should have thought you got quite tired of hearing people say, 'God save the king,'" said the queen. "I can't quite think why those girls wanted to teach their parrots to say it too."
"The sentiment is admirable," said the king,
and I never mind how often I hear it, but I do get tired of hearing those parrots say Pretty Polly. They say it in 7 different languages, said the princesses.
I dare to say they do, said the king, but it reminds me too much of my counselors. They say the same thing in 7 different ways, and it never means anything in any way they say it.
The princesses, their characters, as I have already said, being naturally embittered, were vexed at this, and the parrots looked very glum indeed. But the Princess September ran through all the rooms of the palace, singing like a lark, while the little bird flew round and round her, singing like a nightingale, which indeed it was. Things went on like this for several days, and then the 8 princesses put their heads together. They went to September and sat down in a circle round her, hiding their feet, as it is proper for Siamese princesses to do.
"My poor September," they said, "we are so sorry for the death of your beautiful parrot. It must be dreadful for you not to have a pet bird as we have, so we have put all our pocket money together, and we are going to buy you a lovely green and yellow parrot."
"Thank you for nothing," said September.
This was not very civil of her, but Siamese princesses are sometimes a little short with one another.
"I have a pet bird which sings the most charming songs to me, and I don't know what on earth I should do with the green and yellow parrot."
January sniffed, then February sniffed, then March sniffed. In fact, all the princesses sniffed, but in their proper order of precedence. When they finished, September asked them, "Why do you sniff? Have you all got colds in your head?"
"Well, my dear," they said, "it's absurd to talk of your bird when the little fellow flies in and out just as he likes."
They looked around the room and raised their eyebrows so high that their foreheads entirely disappeared.
"You'll get dreadful wrinkles," said September.
"Do you mind our asking you where your bird is now?" they said.
"He's gone to pay a visit to his father-in-law," said the Princess September. "And what makes you think he'll come back?" asked the princesses.
"He always does come back," said September.
"Well, my dear," said the 8 princesses, "if you'll take our advice, you won't run any risks like that. If he comes back, and mind you, if he does, you'll be lucky, pop him into the cage and keep him there. That's the only way you can be sure of him."
"But I like to have him fly about the room," said Princess September.
"Safety first," said her sisters ominously.
They got up and walked out of the room, shaking their heads, and left September very uneasy. It seemed to her that her little bird was away a long time, and she could not think what he was doing. Something might have happened to him. What with hawks and men with snares, you never knew what trouble he might get into. Besides, he might forget her, or he might take a fancy to somebody else. That would be dreadful. Oh, she wished he were safely back again, and in the golden cage that stood there empty and ready. For when the maids of honor had buried the dead parrot, they had left the cage in its old place. Suddenly September heard a tweet-tweet just behind her ear, and she saw the little bird sitting on her shoulder. He had come in so quietly and alighted so softly that she had not heard him.
"I wondered what on earth had become of you," said the princess.
"I thought you'd wonder that," said the little bird. "The fact is, I very nearly didn't come back tonight at all. My father-in-law was giving a party, and they all wanted me to stay. But I thought you'd be anxious."
Under the circumstances, this was a very unfortunate remark for the little bird to make. September felt her heart go thump, thump against her chest, and she made up her mind to take no more risks. She put up her hand and took hold of the bird. This he was quite used to. She liked feeling his heart go pit-a-pat, so fast, in the hollow of her hand, and I think he liked the soft warmth of her little hand. So the bird suspected nothing, and he was so surprised when she carried him over to the cage and popped him in and shut the door on him that for a moment he could think of nothing to say. But in a moment or two he hopped up on the ivory perch and said,
"What is the joke?" There's no joke, said September, but some of Mama's cats are prowling about tonight, and I think you're much safer in there. I can't think why the Queen wants to have all those cats, said the little bird rather crossly. Well, you see, they're very special cats, said the princess. They have blue eyes and a kink in their tails, and they're a specialty of the royal family, if you understand what I mean. Perfectly, said the little bird. But why did you put me in this cage without saying anything about it? I don't think it's the sort of place I like.
I shouldn't have slept a wink all night if I hadn't known you were safe.
Well, just for this once I don't mind, said the little bird, so long as you let me out in the morning.
He ate a very good supper and then began to sing, but in the middle of his song he stopped.
I don't know what's the matter with me, he said, but I don't feel like singing tonight.
Very well, said September. Go to sleep instead.
So he put his head under his wing and in a minute was fast asleep. September went to sleep too, but when the dawn broke she was awakened by the little bird calling her at the top of his voice.
Wake up! Wake up! He said. Open the door of this cage and let me out. I want to have a good fly while the dew is still on the ground.
You're much better off where you are, said September. You have a beautiful golden cage. It was made by the best workmen in my papa's kingdom, and my papa was so pleased with it that he cut off his head so he should never make another.
Let me out, said the little bird.
You'll have 3 meals a day served by my maids of honor. You'll have nothing to worry you from morning till night, and you can sing to your heart's content.
Let me out, said the little bird.
And he tried to slip through the bars of the cage, but of course he couldn't, and he beat against the door, but of course he couldn't open it. Then the 8 princesses came in and looked at him. They told September she was very wise to take their advice. They said he would soon get used to the cage, and in a few days would quite forget that he had ever been free. The little bird said nothing at all while they were there, but as soon as they were gone he began to cry again.
Let me out! Let me out! Don't be such an old silly, said September. I've only put you in the cage because I'm so fond of you. I know what's good for you much better than you do yourself. Sing me a little song, and I'll give you a piece of brown sugar.
But the little bird stood in the corner of his cage, looking out at the blue sky, and never sang a note. He never sang all day.
What's the good of skulking? Said September. Why don't you sing and forget your troubles?
How can I sing? Answered the bird. I want to see the trees and the lake and the green rice growing in the fields.
If that's all you want, I'll take you for a walk, said September.
She picked up the cage and went out, and she walked down to the lake round which grew the willow trees, and she stood at the edge of the rice fields that stretched as far as the eye could see.
I'll take you out every day, she said. I love you, and I only want to make you happy.
It's not the same thing, said the little bird. The rice fields and the lake and the willow trees look quite different when you see them through the bars of a cage.
So she brought him home again and gave him his supper. But he wouldn't eat a thing. The princess was a little anxious at this and asked her sisters what they thought about it.
You must be firm, they said.
But if he won't eat, he'll die, she answered.
That would be very ungrateful for him, they said. He must know that you're only thinking of his own good. If he's obstinate and dies, it'll serve him right, and you'll be rid of him.
September didn't see how that was going to do her very much good, but they were 8 to 1 and all older than she, so she said nothing.
Perhaps he'll have got used to his cage by tomorrow, she said.
And next day when she awoke, she cried out, "Good morning," in a cheerful voice. She got no answer. She jumped up out of bed and ran to the cage. She gave a startled cry, for there the little bird lay at the bottom on his side with his eyes closed, and he looked as if he were dead.
She opened the door, and putting her hand in, lifted him out. She gave a sob of relief, for she felt that his little heart was still beating.
Wake up, little bird, she said.
She began to cry, and her tears fell on the little bird. He opened his eyes and felt that the bars of the cage were no longer round him.
I cannot sing unless I'm free, and if I cannot sing, I die, he said.
The princess gave a great sob. Then take your freedom, she said. I shut you in a golden cage because I loved you and wanted to have you all to myself. But I never knew it would kill you. Go, fly away among the trees that are round the lake and fly over the green rice fields. I love you enough to let you be happy in your own way.
She threw open the window and gently placed the little bird on the sill. He shook himself a little.
Come and go as you will, little bird, she said. I will never put you in a cage any more.
I will come because I love you, little princess, said the bird, and I will sing you the loveliest songs I know. I shall go far away, but I will always come back, and I shall never forget you.
He gave himself another shake.
Good gracious me, how stiff I am, he said.
Then he opened his wings and flew right away into the blue. But the little princess burst into tears, for it is very difficult to put the happiness of someone you love before your own. And with her little bird far out of sight, she felt on a sudden very lonely. When her sisters knew what had happened, they mocked her and said that the little bird would never return. But he did at last, and he sat on September's shoulder and ate out of her hand and sang her the beautiful songs he had learned while he was flying up and down the far places of the world. September kept her window open day and night so that the little bird might come into her room whenever he felt inclined, and this was very good for her. So she grew extremely beautiful. And when she was old enough, she married the king of Cambodia and was carried all the way to the city in which he lived on a white elephant. But her sisters never slept with their windows open, so they grew extremely ugly as well as disagreeable, and when the time came to marry them off, they were given away to the king's counselors with a pound of tea and a Siamese cat.
This brings us to the end of an hour of short stories, which originated from NTRB, North Texas Radio for the Blind, Dallas. For more about this program, visit www.anhourofshortstories.com. I'm John Pritchett. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Hello once again, Audio Journal listeners. I would like to take time to wish all the mothers a very happy Mother's Day from us to you and to all. Happy Mother's Day from all of us at Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear.
We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.